CliffCentral.com. Every Thursday we check in on the Burning Platform. Last week we had a delay and did it on Friday, and Canthan Pillay was good enough to join us and give us his insight into some of the stories in the news. But every week with Nando's, we try to bring you some of the things that you might want to discuss with your work colleagues, with your smart friends. You know, let people know that you're on top of stuff. And occasionally we look a little further afield than South Africa. And we are going to check in with our good friend Justice Malala, who's now living in Los Angeles soon. I spoke to him just the other day. And we're going to speak to a number of very credible, very interesting South African and foreign journalists over the course of the next couple of weeks. So the Burning Platform is bound to get a lot more exciting. One of the people we love to talk to is Simon Allison. Simon is a regular contributor here. He was also a part-time host of one of our shows here on CliffCentral.com. But he is with the Mail and Guardian, and he joins us this morning. How are you, Simon?
Good morning. I'm very well.
Nice to speak to you. You are our foremost Africa expert in South Africa, and I love talking to you because it gives us a chance to just look north a little bit and pay attention to some of the stories that most people aren't entirely aware of, and if they are aware of them, they know all the stuff tangentially. You dig deep. You tell us all about Uganda. You tell us all about what's going on in Liberia, and we've got lots of things we want to cover with you today. But welcome back to the show. It's always nice to hear from you.
It is always a pleasure to speak to you.
So, Simon, where do we begin? Here locally, there's quite a lot of discussion around Pegasus, right? This is not the horse from Greek mythology. Perseus rode with the wings. Pegasus is a notorious spyware program, right?
It's actually pretty scary stuff. So a report came out a couple of days ago from the Citizen Lab, which is a sort of cyber accountability think tank in Canada.
Yes.
And they did some really, really complicated research that I have to confess, I do not understand how they did it. Mm-hmm. But they basically traced the spyware program to infected telephones in 45 different countries. South Africa was one of those countries. Now, here's where it gets interesting. This spyware is a sort of a licensed product made by an Israeli company that is only sold by governments. So if your phone is infected with Pegasus, it means some government agency somewhere is spying on you. And in the past, this software has been used not for sort of getting your bank details or any of that kind of stuff. It's been used to spy on journalists and human rights activists.
Oh.
And it is very concerning that its presence has been found in South Africa and indeed in 12 African countries in total.
So have you immediately gone on to all the computers at the Mail and Guardian, for example, and checked whether there's Pegasus that's been installed as malware on any of your devices?
So it's actually just on phones.
Okay.
And it's very hard, almost impossible to check. So what the Committee to Protect Journalists is kind of saying is, if you think, you know, if you have credible reason to think you might have Pegasus on your phone, you kind of just have to buy a new phone. There isn't really a way to tell if you're infected unless you take it to some kind of expert who really knows these things. But your sort of guy in the mobile shop in the mall isn't going to be able to do it for you.
Now, do we know where the origin of these installations is? Do we know whether it's Russia, whether it's America, whether it's local, whether it's our own NIS? I mean, are they even capable of figuring out what Pegasus is?
We don't know. And the South African State Security, we did approach them for comment on the story, but they haven't responded to us. The research seems to suggest that there are several operators within the African continent. One of the big ones seems to be based in Morocco. Another big one is based in Togo. And both of those countries have very poor track records when it comes to tolerating free speech and treating human rights activists and journalists well. Other than that, it's quite murky. It's hard to get to the bottom of it just because it is really so complicated to pin down where this spyware is and who is controlling it. So we really know just the surface of what's going on, but it is really, really concerning.
Would you be concerned if you were a journalist that they were spying on your conversations, whoever they are, that they would be figuring out who your sources are for stories, that kind of thing?
Exactly. I mean, this stuff is powerful. It can pretty much hoover up every single detail on your phone, including all your contact lists, all your conversations, all your WhatsApps, all your call logs. It is the sort of stuff that totalitarian wet dreams are made of. Wow. And once they have access to your phone, they have access to everything. So all your sources are compromised. All your information is compromised. It's pretty scary.
Sure, that's horrendous. Are you concerned you might have it on your phone?
I am. And I don't know what to do about it because I'm not sure, us journalists, as you well know, Gareth, don't exactly rake in the big bucks. I'm not sure I can afford to just replace my phone on a regular basis.
Of course.
So I need to just be careful about the conversations I have and how I have them.
Well, you know what? If they're going to come and get you, they're going to come and get you. But the fact is, I don't really have – just like you couldn't get an answer out of the National Intelligence Agency – on whether or not they knew anything about this software. I don't think they even know what day of the week it is, so I wouldn't be too concerned about them.
I'm not sure, Gareth. The South African Intelligence Service has a pretty good reputation when it comes to targeted surveillance. So if they want to know what you're doing, they have the means to do so. And that's come from a few reliable sources.
Okay. No, I'll give it to you then. Fine. If you say that we must be wary of them, then we'll be wary of them. Better to be forewarned and forearmed than to do nothing, right?
Exactly. And it might not necessarily be the South Africans spying on South Africans.
No.
We know that other governments are also very interested in what South Africans get up to. We also have large diaspora communities in South Africa, which may be targeted by their own governments.
Absolutely.
There are a lot of potential ways in which this can be abused.
All right. Well, it's not just journalists, though. Everybody should be concerned about this because if you're a source for a journalist, you might be in trouble too. Who knows?
Exactly. It may be safer to go back to the sort of old days of writing coded letters. That might be best bet.
Imagine like Morse code across a closed network. So let's just talk about Africa for a second, because there's quite a lot going on the continent, and we tend to be very inward facing in South Africa. We tend to look only at our problems and imagine that we're an island. What's going on in Uganda at the moment? I've heard about this treason case.
So what is happening in Uganda is actually fascinating, and I think it's representative of broader patterns that are changing politics on the African continent. So just to wrap it up very quickly, there's a rapper. He's a rapper. He's a reggae star called Bobby Wine. He's kind of the Casper Nyovest of Uganda.
Right.
And he was very merrily doing his thing, making music, making saucy music videos, and getting into, beefs with other rappers. And then a couple of years ago, he kind of had a road to Damascus moment, an epiphany, where he was like, you know what? I grew up in the slums in Kampala, and nothing's changed. I grew up in poverty. I was lucky to escape, but the rest of the people I grew up with haven't. And the government is not looking after us. And I need to be using my platform as a celebrity musician to make change. And his lyrics started becoming more political. And then he ran for parliament in his local constituency, and he won resoundingly. And since then, he has supported two or three other candidates, independent candidates, who have run for a parliamentary seat. And these guys were not part of any big established elites. They weren't supposed to win, but all of the candidates he backed have won. So his endorsement was enough to sort of help them over the line. And the Ugandan government is absolutely terrified because they are not sure that they can control this new threat. He's so popular. He seems to have tapped into a well of resentment in Uganda that the government didn't even know about. And he is really maximizing it for political gain, and he wants to make change. And so they've cracked down on him. They have attacked several of his demonstrations.
Accusing people of treason is terrifying. That's a capital crime in Uganda.
It is with a very, very stiff penalty. The treason case has been adjourned till December, but I mean, in the meantime, they arrested him. I think about 4 or 5 weeks ago, arrested him and quite brutally tortured him. He was held in military barracks, and when he emerged, he couldn't walk. He was in a wheelchair. He had to go to the United States for medical attention. So it's really scary. And I think what's really scaring the Ugandan government the most is that it's kind of a demographic thing. If you look at the big picture, where Bobby Wine, that's his name, Bobby Wine, where his support base is coming from, mm-hmm. is in Uganda's cities. Now, cities have always been a sort of hotbed of opposition in pretty much every African country. I mean, even in this country, the big metros are where the opposition kind of enjoy the most power.
That's where your educated people know they have more options and they aren't enthralled and they aren't dependent on social welfare and all of that stuff that makes them feel that they have to keep doing what they were doing and that they're effectively owned like serfs by the noblemen.
And that there's a lot more communications, there's a lot more information. People in cities tend to have a much clearer picture of what's going on,
sure.
or at least they think they do. And that's all well and good because historically the rural areas, the population in the rural areas has been much greater than the population in the cities in most African countries. And so as long as you control the rural areas, you don't need to worry about what's happening in the cities. But that's changing because as urbanization increases, more and more people are coming to the cities, and those proportions are changing. And we are seeing the politics changing along with them. Bobby Wine is a reflection of that. In Zimbabwe, Pastor Ivan Mawerire is a reflection of that. And I think that would-be authoritarian governments, presidents who want to hang in there for life, they don't know how to combat this change. Their normal tactics, which are to keep everyone in the dark, you know, control information, these don't work in the 21st century. They don't work when everyone's living in cities, and they need to come up with a plan B.
Now, I'm concerned. This guy has been tortured, you say. He's being accused of treason. I mean, it sounds to me like they're really cracking down on him hard, which authoritarian regimes tend to do when they find someone who's popular and has a popular voice and who's against them. In this case, what is the population's approach to this? I mean, are they very much on Bobby Wine's side, or is there some undercurrent that we can read here? You know, like the Arab Spring, which was very much on social media. Is there a way we can gauge public support or public dislike of it?
It's very tricky. What we do know is that he seems to be able to attract huge crowds when he wants to make an appearance, when he wants to stage a demonstration. And I think that is a symbol of his popularity. He actually wrote an op-ed in the Mail and Guardian today, mm-hmm. where he said that the writing is on the wall for the regime in Uganda. This was an interesting choice of language. I wonder what exactly he meant by that. Does he mean that he is going to take further action and maybe more sort of energetic action to bring down the regime in Uganda? Or does he just mean it stays unnumbered because it's been in power for too long? You know, are we heading towards an Arab Spring-style revolt in Uganda? I don't think we can rule it out, but I don't think we're quite there yet. I think there is a long way to go. I think Bobby Wine still has to put in quite a lot of work to make sure his message is heard outside of Kampala, outside of the big metros. Uganda does still have a large rural population that will need to be convinced first. But it's really interesting to watch, and I think it's kind of a bellwether case. What happens in Uganda is going to sort of set a path for what's going to happen in other African countries going forward.
Yeah, and we've seen this story play out before, haven't we?
We have. Zimbabwe is a perfect example of it. It kind of was a popular dissatisfaction with Mugabe's regime that paved the way for the military to take control. And I think that people like Bobby Wine will have watched that with great concern because that's not what they want. They don't want to replace one military ruler with another military ruler. That's not really a democratic revolution, even though President Emmerson Mnangagwa in Zimbabwe would dearly like to sort of clothe his administration in those in that democratic guise. So he'll be wanting to make sure that if there is change in Uganda, it is real change and something different comes along.
All right, let's turn our attention to Liberia. Liberia is an interesting country in Africa. It doesn't really follow the historical trajectory of so many other African countries and has had some anomalies during the course of its history. But Liberia apparently is turning into quite the place of protest at the moment. There are thousands of people who took to the streets in Monrovia last week, Monday, to demand the return of $104 million in cash that went missing on its way to the central bank. Now, it's very rare that, and they're not saying, we want that money, we want it returned to whom it belongs. So it's not like the public are just going out there saying, we want land, for example, and hoping that they'll get a scrap of land from the government. They're actually protesting criminality and corruption.
This is the most extraordinary story. So what happened is Liberia, you know, if you want to buy new banknotes as a country, if you're a country and you need to put banknotes into the economy, you need to print those banknotes somewhere.
Sure.
And they're usually printed overseas. I think these ones are printed in Germany, if I'm not mistaken. In Lebanon and Sweden. And they arrived in Liberia in the port of Monrovia in two different shipments. One was last year, one was this year. Neither of those shipments ever made it past the port. So they arrived in the port and then just disappeared. And this is $104 million worth of Liberian banknotes.
Do the words inside job mean anything to you?
Exactly. I mean, this is the heist of the century so far. Like, one day we're going to be watching a exactly happened.
Simon, the heist of the century was what the Guptas did to us because we're so stupid that we let them. Let's not forget that we are in a glass house here. We shouldn't throw stones.
Gareth, I don't know. The Guptas, as bad as they were relatively small fry compared to a lot of the corruption that is going on elsewhere.
$104 million is nothing to the Guptas. We're talking billions.
Either way, it's quite amazing that it can just disappear out of thin air. And what makes it very tricky for the Liberian government, which is new, by the way. So the current Liberian president, he was inaugurated earlier this year.
That's right.
George Weah,
in
the
January,
football star.
Right? Yeah.
And I'm always suspicious of, football stars who want to become politicians. It seems like a strange career path. But George Weah has stuck at it for a long time. He's been in opposition for ages. But now, the first batch went missing under Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's administration. The second batch went missing under George Weah's administration.
Sure.
So it's not like either party can throw stones at the other in this particular instance.
Yeah, first of all, I don't find that suspicious at all. George Weah went into this because he saw a huge payday. And second of all, I'm suspicious of footballers going into politics, but I'm more suspicious of politicians who are in politics than I am of anyone from the outside trying to come in.
Fair enough. And perhaps even more suspicious is politicians who go into football.
Oh, yes.
Like Burundi's president, Pierre Nkurunziza, who I think it was last year he arrested somebody because he got tackled on the football pitch in a way he was not happy with.
You know, it's like those medieval monarchs that you read about in the history books, these guys in like the 1300s who would chop off someone's head because they didn't throw down a cloak over a puddle for the king to walk on. It's bizarre that we still have this in 2018. Simon, if we can come back home for a minute, I hear Zwelinzima Vavi is in trouble.
Zwelinzima Vavi is in trouble. I mean, Zwelinzima Vavi seems to have made his own trouble, and he seems to have a consistent track record of being accused of pretty serious sexual harassment.
Hashtag me too. What's going on with him?
So it was about a year ago that he was alleged to have sexually harassed a cleaner in his office. And this allegation has been hanging over him for a while. It hasn't been made public until this week. And we believe that this was partly due to the sort of political machinations within the union movement. So, I mean, it seems like one of the factions, and I don't fully understand all the complicated politics going on there, but one of the factions is trying to use the sexual harassment allegation as a way to, hurt Zwelinzima Vavi. But that to me is irrelevant. There is pretty convincing supporting evidence suggesting that this, making this claim quite compelling. And that to me is the story, no matter where it came from. Guys like Zwelinzima Vavi seem to have got away with doing this for a long time. And it's not just him. I mean, the roll call of prominent South African figures who've been caught up in pretty serious sexual harassment allegations is quite staggering. There's Zwelinzima Vavi. There's Ivor Chipkin, the academic who recently had to step down from his position and not launch his own book because of similar allegations. There is, of course, Duron Isaacs at Equal Education. Zaki Ahmed, who was accused of helping cover up those sexual harassment allegations. There really seems to be a spate. And I think it is, in large part, a reflection of the broader Me Too movement in South Africa. And certainly when the Mail and Guardian worked on the Equal Education case, several of the survivors we spoke to said that they were directly inspired by Me Too to speak out. They saw other women speaking out and they thought, I can do that. And they are doing it. And it takes incredible bravery to do something like that. I don't think we fully appreciate, especially as men in positions of privilege and wealth, mm-hmm. we don't appreciate how difficult it is to speak out about sexual harassment. We also don't appreciate how fierce the backlash can be and how ugly it is. And we certainly have been seeing that as well in reaction to these stories.
Well, it all stems, I think, from years and years and years of just of ugliness and male toxicity and all kinds of other things. But there's also a part of this that is that almost seems to be embedded in our culture. And I think Reedy Tlabi addresses this really well in her book about the woman who was raped by President Jacob Zuma, and allegedly, and who died, Kwesi, not so long ago. So I think that's something worth reading if you're someone who actually does care about this stuff. And it's also worth remarking that people like Zwelinzima Vavi keep their jobs. Here we've got Brett Kavanaugh in America, who's trying to stand for a Justice of the Supreme Court position, and he is being examined from beginning to end. Now, if we had to fine comb the lives of just about anyone in South African politics, with very few exceptions, we would find such ugliness that I don't think anybody would make a quarter of the headway that Brett Kavanaugh has made in his hearings. I think we'd have a lot of people with a lot of questions that that deserve and need answering, and plenty of women along the way who've been shut up, bullied, told to keep quiet. We've got an ugliness in our politics that seems to tolerate this kind of thing. I don't know where it stems from. I'm not a psychologist, but it seems to me there are lots and lots. You've already indicated cases in NGOs, for example. But within the government, too, we've heard all kinds of murmurs of men in powerful positions who have their way with women who work under them.
You know, I don't think it is a uniquely South African thing at all. I think the more that we understand about the way sexual harassment works, the more we're seeing it is an entrenched culture pretty much everywhere and across every industry. And I think one of the reasons that it's coming out first in South Africa amongst NGOs and amongst leftist political institutions is because these institutions are a little bit more progressive than other industries, and the people involved are more readily taking a stand and sort of being braver in coming to speak out. But certainly other industries in the country, in the world, are just as toxic, just as problematic. And I think this really is only the tip of the iceberg.
Well, maybe it's that, or maybe it's also that the kind of men who are attracted to these leftist organizations are the kind of men who abuse. I mean, I'm just saying, maybe there's something in it.
I don't think so. I think that what we're learning from this is abuse.
Let's do the research. I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying. Simon, What about this situation with Donald Trump at the moment? I mean, he's always in the news, and I see that that just in the last couple of days, he's been getting a lot of attention. Last week, obviously, at the UN, he got laughed at, and people thought that was very funny. He didn't. He thinks people were laughing with him, not at him. But I see he is he's making some headway with this Kavanaugh situation by mocking the woman who is his accuser. Have you seen the story?
I have seen the story. I've also seen the reaction from several of the swing Republican senators. These are the senators upon whose vote Brett Kavanaugh is depending. And they indicated that they were quite unimpressed with Donald Trump's impression. And I wonder if that's going to have any impact on the vote. And of course, closer to home, we've got Melania Trump visiting the African continent. I'm sure we're all very excited.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to ask you what she's doing here because you pay attention to these things. What does she want to achieve here in Africa?
You know, so at the Mail and Guardian, we haven't covered Melania's visit to Africa, and a few people have asked us why. And in short, my response is because we don't really care. She seems to be coming with some very random initiative.
You guys would be all over this if it was Michelle Obama, wouldn't you?
Yeah, because we'd be a lot more interested in what she has to say.
You'd be all. This is her first visit, her first international trip as a first lady on her own, and you don't care. But if it was Michelle Obama, you'd be listening intently with all ears, right?
I mean, look, we're listening intently to Melania, but nothing that has she said has indicated.
Simon, you said you don't care. Don't change your script halfway through.
No, look, I don't think Melania has indicated any kind of interest in the African continent,
She's
and I
here.
Don't think Donald Trump has.
She's here, and Donald Trump has not yet suspended a AGOA, so you should be grateful. Isn't that true?
We are all thankful to Donald Trump, our savior.
Well, he's certainly doing the best he can for the American economy. Don't you wish we had him here instead of Cyril with our zero and less growth, our petrol prices going up, our taxes going up, Eskom still a disaster, or is it not
worth
giving him?
I mean, he's not doing the best for the American economy.
Yes, Decker. He is. Unemployment's at record lows, Simon. That's undisputed. Even the Democrats say that's impressive.
If you look at the way that growth is spread out, it's almost entirely in the very top tier of society. So, yes, the overall numbers look decent.
Simon.
But that's because the money's all being concentrated in one particular area. While at the same time, none of it's being used to actually create the institutions. And
Simon, Simon, you get GDP,
eviscerating
GDP growth
the American government.
Either there's growth or there isn't. There's growth. You can't tell me you're going to break it down and say it's
not spread. That's a nonsense measure. GDP is not an effective measure of overall prosperity, and that has been shown by economists in multiple studies. And it's us journalists who don't understand these things that parrot GDP and as this be all and end all without understanding the nuances that then create these misunderstandings.
All right. Jobs? I mean, jobs and unemployment? You don't think that that's an achievement?
Yes, but I mean, a lot of it was due to the policies that Obama implemented. You don't solve unemployment in 2 years.
Okay. But then, what if Obama was taking credit for George W. Bush's movements and saving the banks and so on, bailing them out and all that stuff? What if that's what was going on? We can't play this game, surely. It's 2 years into Trump's presidency.
Gareth, how quickly do you think unemployment indicators change? Not quickly.
Well, when you, for example, start a tariff war with China and bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States, that's a very real, immediate, and measurable thing.
I don't think that's true.
Okay.
I guess you started the tariff war, but I don't think that's brought a whole bunch of jobs back.
I don't think Obama started the tariff war.
Yes, I don't think the tariff war is benefiting anybody.
Oh, okay. So American jobs are then going down.
No, the jobs that are going up are as a result of long-term policies. They don't change overnight.
Okay. I just like having these arguments from time to time, Simon, because I know that you're on the opposite side of the spectrum. It's always nice to talk to you. Thank you for your insights into Africa, and thank you for giving us some opinions on the Trump situation. It's always good to hear from you, and I also enjoy your outlook on the local situation with all of our politicians and NGOs misbehaving. But I suppose we've got to keep an eye on these people, an eagle eye, because otherwise they'll all get out of control, including Trump.
Great. Always nice to be on. Thanks, Gareth.
Thanks, Simon. Cheers. Bye-bye. There's Simon Allison, The Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. Yep. It's loads of things to talk about. It's not as if we run out of material. The world is only getting more interesting, and there's only more of it to learn about. CliffCentral.com